Thank you. My collaborators are Scott Glasgow, who's here, of course, and also a former student that's now at NIST, Michael Ware. He did a lot of this work, and there he is. In fact, many of the animations that you'll see in this talk, he generated on a computer. I thought it'd be interesting for us at this conference to remember the first attempts to measure the speed of light that were made by Galileo. I don't know if he was the very first, but one of the earliest. He had a lamp and covered it up and suddenly pulled the cover off. He sent his student across the valley with a similar lamp and instructions to uncover the lamp as soon as he saw the flash from the first lamp. And then Galileo tried to record the amount of time it took from when he first uncovered his lamp until he could see the signal coming back. And of course, you can then figure out the velocity. And being the good scientist that he was, he made the right conclusion. I was unable to make sure whether the facing light appeared instantaneously. But if not instantaneous, light is very swift. He made a further remark that I think is maybe still relevant nearly 4 centuries later. He said, "But in what seas are we inadvertently engulfing ourselves bit by bit? Among voids, infinities, indivisibles, and instantaneous movements, shall we ever be able to reach a harbor even after 1,000 discussions?"
This implies that he foresaw calculus.
Okay. Well, I wanted to begin my talk talking a little bit about angularly dispersive systems, that is, grating pairs that are used for compression and grating systems, and then move on to a broadband context of group delay, upside down, and group velocity. And then I'll make some comments about some conclusions one can draw about the bandwidth-dependent transition from superluminal to subluminal propagation. So by way of introduction, if you'll permit me to tell a little bit about how we got started into investigating this. We were interested in knowing how pulses propagate between a grating pair. In this viewpoint, which was published by Tracy back in 1969, you take a trace a representative ray through the system, and of course this ray will be a little bit different depending on the frequency of the light. The angle of diffraction will obey this diffraction equation for gratings. And you can compute the acquired phase that the light will have upon going from here to the grating to some benchmark plane here. And if you're interested in that phase, one would presumably take this path and that path, which again depend on the frequency, and divide through by the wavelength and find that phase. But that would be wrong. It turns out you need a correction, which Tracy called a phase matching term. It amounts to 2 pi times the number of grooves along the grating. So it depends where you hit on here. It's a phase correction that has to be there to get the right answer. In 88, Borson and House pointed out that the derivative of this phase needs to match the group delay along this path. And so, while this might seem straightforward, if you take these functions, they're functions of frequency, put them in here and do the derivative, you have to remember pretty much everything your trigonometry teacher taught you in order to show that. It takes quite a bit of work. So it doesn't seem obvious from the start, but it seems like this derivative, this group delay, is playing an important role in this grating system, and we were interested in that. The traditional way to see that, of course, is in this expansion of the phase function. Here's the phase also equals k dot delta r. You can expand it out, and you see this derivative appearing in the first term, evaluated at whatever frequency you're choosing to expand around. Now, what seemed kind of maybe subtle here is that the answer you're going to get if you refer to this as the speed it takes for the pulse to go through the system as it's chirping is going to depend on what frequency you choose to expand around. If you choose the center frequency or a side frequency, you'll get a different answer. And of course, the higher order terms then come into play a role. In fact, laser physicists now tend to look at about five different terms here to evaluate the pulse. So we were interested in getting a deeper understanding of how this works. There's a little movie of a short laser pulse represented coming into a grating and then diffracting different frequency components going in different directions. In fact, this curve shows you the direction of the pointing vector distributed through space as this pulse is going. We wanted to consider how much time would it take for a pulse to go from, say, a point here after it's reflected. So say from a point here to how long until it passes some other point downstream. And so to talk about that, we needed to define an arrival time. And this is how we did it, just a time expectation over the pointing vector. So here's the energy per time arriving. And you'll notice this little dot product we have. That would be the orientation of the detector, which is important because different parts of the wave are going different directions. And so that can also affect the arrival time. But when we went with this definition for arrival time, and did some analysis, we found that this difference in arrival time from one point to a new point, R plus delta R, came out to a rather simple expression that involved this group delay. It's a frequency sort of an expectation integral with this decay d omega inside here. Here's that derivative. And so the conclusion, and by the way, this frequency distribution function is simply the pointing vector in omega space. So it's the spectral content of the pulse. And so you take this group delay and you simply make a linear superposition according to how much spectrum is in your pulse, and that's what the answer has to be. Okay, so we started wondering how this kind of analysis might be applied to other scenarios, such as pulse propagation that we've heard a lot about already, in the absorbing case where the pulse can appear to come out ahead, and also in the amplifying case, similarly, the resulting pulse can be ahead of the incoming pulse. And so we wanted to do that, to look at the more or less this time of transmission, what's the time between those. Regardless of what shape this might have, we thought we'd use this indication of arrival time as an average of the pulse. So we're not paying attention to the shapes and how it evolves, but just to this average. Okay, this by no means, of course, is a can replace the full solution. If you want to know the shape of the pulse, you go through the decomposition into the Fourier components, and you adjust them by the phase K delta R, and then reconstitute the pulse to find out what's downstream. Of course, in the past, the traditional way, well, still the traditional way to view this is to expand this K delta R and to look at this term. We're not going to do that. In our case, we want to rely on or to accept the possibility of broadband pulses. And so we won't make this expansion. But if you have narrow band pulse, the expansion, of course, is OK. So in the limit of narrow band, we should be able to recover this kind of concept. OK. I'll define that here on the next slide. So here's cases where you can get away with the expansion. You can be fairly broadband as long as you're away from a resonance, because you can make the expansion and the function so boring out here that you can represent it quite well with just a few terms. Also, if you're right on the resonance, you can get away with the expansion as long as you're narrow band, narrow meaning narrow with respect to the resonance, because there are poles in the complex plane associated with these two humps, and that sort of defines how far over which you can expand. And so this bottom case you cannot do in the expansion. In fact, the integral won't even converge if you try to, or the expansion won't converge if you try to put in frequencies that are too far away from omega bar. Okay, again, the expansion, you cannot do it. Kurt Oxton pointed out in 97 how the pulses become so distorted that this representation of group velocity in terms of the expansion is inappropriate. So we needed a different definition of pulse arrival time, which is the one we used for the grading. So we're going to use the same center of mass kind of concept for arrival of the pulse. And again, we're integrating over a distribution function, which is the normalized pointing vector, to say sometime when the pulse arrives, regardless of its shape. Okay, when you do that, you get a similar expression like we had in the case of the grading. Remember, in the case of the grading, we had no absorption going on. Here we have some absorption going on. It turns out we get a piece that looks just like we had before, involving the real part of K, but the imaginary part of K, which we did not have previously, comes into play also. And I'll describe those. Okay, so here's the piece for the time delay traveling from one point to the next, which again is a linear superposition of the group delay. And so there's the group delay function, whatever your chi is, you can generate that. And this would be a spectral distribution, which is essentially the shape of what you measure in your spectrometer, S of omega. And you oh, that's a good point. Why is it that way? You care about what's going to make it during propagation. So you do take the spectrum that's going to survive to the final point. That's the one that you care about. Turns out you can reverse this. I'm going to talk about this reshaping piece. You find this before you propagate. And then this one is on the final spectrum, but you can do the order opposite. You can do this one at the final position and do this on the initial spectrum if you like. Okay, so the reshaping term is given kind of by this expression at the bottom. It looks a little complicated, but the interpretation is very simple, and that is before propagation, so we're at the initial position, we're going to consider the time center of mass of this pulse with and without the spectrum that will be lost. So you simply... I use that for group and reshaping. There are just two pieces here. And so this reshaping piece is simply before propagating anywhere, you have an initial pulse which, for example, might be chirped. If during transit you expect some of these, say, the green spectral amplitude components to disappear, then you simply remove those, and that's what this piece does. And the center of mass will shift over a little bit, so you have to compensate for that. In all the examples that I'm going to show, I'm going to start with a pulse which is not chirped, in which case the reshaping term is negligible. So we'll be concentrating primarily on this piece. It's just a function which I had defined there at the bottom. It looked a little ugly, so I hid it. Okay, this is the same as, yeah, it's right here. The interpretation of it is, it turns out in omega space, this is the same as my original definition. Where did it go? Clear back here. Oh, right there. My original definition written this way. Well, it's the pointing vector time arrival. This is not momentum, but just a distribution function rho. And so you can write that time arrival in terms of functions that are functions of frequency. And that's what it looks like. But in any case, that's what you need to do if you want to talk about time of arrival to a point with and without some spectrum and to see the reshaping effect. So.
It refers to a kind of, what if you have a double peak pulse?
A double peak pulse.
Yeah.
Well, it could turn into anything. What I care about in terms of, you're talking about the reshaping piece.
I'm talking about the definition of time average.
Oh, if you have a double peak pulse, you'll have the center of somewhere between them. So you can have any kind of crazy shape function you like. It has a center somewhere.
Yeah.
I think that's one of Kurt Oxton's comments was, does it make sense to talk about the average velocity of two cars if you're a policeman? And so in a sense, we're not looking at the details of the pulse, but we're just saying the pulse has a center and here's a way to define it. And we've noticed that that the center has something to do with the group delay. And so it's an interpretation one can give it. Okay, so again, as I'm saying, this reshaping effect, I'm going to not have any examples where that's important. You have to have a chirp pulse, initially chirp pulse for that. Okay, so let's do some examples. We'll use a Lorentz oscillator to represent the medium. Of course, this could be applied with any arbitrary chi, but this is for convenience. And we'll send a pulse through, and we'll track its time of transit according to the center of mass definition. Here we have the index of refraction, real and imaginary parts. Here's the group delay function, this decay d omega. And so that's that function. And we care about the final spectrum, what you would measure with a spectrometer at the final position. That's what goes in here to weight this integrand. And here I've represented a fairly narrow band pulse. And so the initial spectrum is blue, and the final spectrum is red. Now, the amount of light that comes out is very weak, but when it's normalized, those curves look almost the same. So we're going to take the red curve, multiply it by this group delay curve, and do the integral, and we'll get a single point, the bottom point right here on this curve. Which tells you the amount of time it took to go through. And in this case, it's an example of superluminal behavior, so it's negative time. These other points on this curve are if I choose my initial pulse to have a frequency centered at other frequencies. And so I can move this curve around on there and find what it would be if I have a pulse that's off resonance, then the transit time is not superluminal, and right on resonance, we see that it is. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and that's right. Makes the integral easy to do if this is a delta function, which is essentially what I have. Yeah. Yes.
Can you talk about the relation of your definition to, say, the definition of
velocity? Well, I wasn't planning on it. You mean of group velocity?
No.
Well, I think there's no inconsistency at all, and I think it's just what Joe had said. If you take a narrow enough spectrum, then the integral just becomes this. I mean, that's a delta function. You get this out, and so you get that term in the Taylor series expansion, and so it agrees exactly. S over U, you mean?
Right, but no, it's what's different from V1 and Sommerfeld's original definition of U was different. The way that it used to
I will talk about that some a little later in my talk. So right now we're just looking at group velocities and we're not being not contradicting, as far as I know, any earlier work, just kind of showing how this works. Now, that example was not very interesting. What gets interesting is when you start doing broadband, where the integral is important to perform. And in that case, it's the exact same mathematics, but here, our original pulse coming in is a nice, it's a shorter in time Gaussian with broader frequency distribution. And in this case, when the pulse goes through, the final spectrum has this hole eaten out of it. And so exactly these fast components of frequency are then end up missing. So they don't, in a sense, get to participate. And the result of multiplying the two red curves and integrating is this point up here. Of course, I can then move my original pulse spectrum around and generate other points. And we'll see that in this case, you don't get any superluminal behavior. Okay, so here's an example contrasting the two pulses on a log scale. Again, we're doing absorption. You see in the top case, that's broadband. The center of mass, this green line is the material. The center of mass of the pulse is coming out ahead of that going in. The bottom case where we had a narrower pulse in time, the center of mass is coming out later. And again, that's governed by the spectral integral. Okay, let's do the amplifying case. It's quite similar. So we've inverted our index here. Here's our group delay function. Here's the narrowband case. So when you think of this curve as the convolution of that with that, again, the delta function-like case. Pulse behaving superluminally off resonance, a little bit to either side if we choose our input pulse a little bit off resonance. Here's the broadband case. You, of course, your initial spectral distribution that is that, but if you send it through, you get this amplification of the on-resonance frequencies. So you pick up all of the lots of energy at these slow frequencies, and the result, if you multiply that curve and integrate, will be a point right there. And you see even quite a ways off resonance. I guess it's still perhaps slightly superluminal right here. But you see this effect has largely been washed out. So we can, here's the movie of this case. Again, you see the broadband case coming out way slower. Okay, one can graph the delay time as a function of depth. And you see, this kind of answers the question that you, if one wonders, can you propagate superluminally indefinitely, or if not, how far? And this answers the question. You see this gradual transition as you propagate. You begin to pick up the slow frequency components, or lose the fast ones, depending if you're absorbing or amplifying. This one's an amplifier, so we pick up all these slow frequencies on resonance, and at a certain depth, we make this transition to slower transit. No, not due to chirping. And in fact, this group delay function that we're looking at doesn't really care about the organization of the pulse, aside from the reshaping at the start. Now, we started unchirped. But you're right, different frequency components each travel with their own speed, so you're for sure chirped downstream. But this is showing just the centroid, or center of the distribution of the energy downstream. And if you try to do the superluminal trick for too far, you simply pick up extra components at the slow speeds, because those are the ones that want to amplify. And pretty soon you have so many of those components that it overwhelms you and you slow down. That's why Bolda and Chow had presented this scheme back in 93. The idea of having an absorber first to absorb off a big hole in the spectrum, right, where you don't want to obtain spectral lines. So they have an absorber followed by an amplifier, and they want to get rid of this spectral energy that could amplify in the second one, so that they could go longer at superluminal speeds. There's also a graph showing the transit time, this delay time through the medium, as a function of bandwidth. So I've plotted this as duration and time of the pulse. So this is a very long pulse in time, so narrow bandwidth out here on the far end. As you give the medium a shorter and shorter pulse, so more bandwidth. At some point, you get enough bandwidth that you leave the superluminal region and travel slower. And it's interesting that this comes down in asymptotes exactly to C. And in fact, that's another easy integral to do when your spectral density that you're integrating against is all frequencies. So if you have a delta function in time, you'll find out from that integral that you travel exactly at C. And that's what this is doing. If you get a short enough pulse, it will asymptote right here to C. Okay, so just to summarize, the group delay function retains meaning even in a broadband context. It is connected with the center of mass of the pointing flux, and this is with no approximation. So you don't have, it's not in terms of an expansion coefficient. The formalism naturally demonstrates that superluminal behavior does not occur for broadband pulses. And no pulse can travel at superluminal speeds indefinitely. Actually, this was shown last year by a group from Japan where they used a femtosecond pulse traveling through a dye cell, and they showed that as they increased the distance, that the thing that traveled initially superluminally wouldn't over longer distances. Oh, it's PRL. I'm sorry, I left that off. Yeah, it is PRL. In fact, this young man, Aminal Talukder, is his name. He contacted me. He's looking for a postdoctoral position now, and I told him I'd tell people at this conference, so I've done that now. So. Okay, now I wanted to move on to part two, the role of the instantaneous spectrum in the behavior of linear dielectrics. And instead of looking at transit of a pulse through an entire medium, we'll be kind of looking, like Scott did yesterday, at a point in the medium. How does it behave as it experiences an electric pulse? I don't know, perhaps before I go on, should I have questions on the first part? Because this is a little bit different topic, or maybe we'll just go on if there's a question on that one. To that later. Okay. So again, this is the animation, just the latter part of what you saw earlier, with a specially prepared incoming pulse that was missing specifically spectral components in the region that would amplify here. And you can get this enormous advance in time, and perhaps limited by the quantum noise that's not really considered here. We're doing everything classically. But I wanted to, we had some discussion on this during the last talk, bring forward these comments made in this review by Steinberg and Chow in Progress in Optics. The inverted medium can temporarily loan part of its stored energy to the forward tail of the wave packet in a pulse reshaping process which moves the peak of the wave packet forward in time. One can think of this pulse reshaping process as the virtual amplification of the forward tail of the wave packet followed by the virtual absorption of the peak, resulting in an advancement of the wave packet. So I think we agree with this statement, and if I were to try to improve upon it at all, I might scratch the words virtual, but we've had some discussion on that already. Here's an excerpt from Wang's paper, where he says, in the present experiment, the probe pulse contains essentially no spectral components that are resonant with the Raman gain lines to be amplified. Therefore, the argument that the probe pulse is advanced by amplification of its front edge does not apply. And I guess the thought is that the word virtual is what makes these two statements compatible, but to me it seems like there's some tension between these two statements. And I'll try to argue why I think that way. Okay, so again we'll consider the response of a point in the medium. And we'll look at Poynting's theorem. So we have the conservation law. The energy density is given by this piece here, E squared plus B squared, the interaction term. you can have a constant of integration here, which can depend on position in space, but is constant in time. And it amounts to what energy the medium has before any pulse arrives. Okay. Now, just to touch on this energy transport velocity, you had a question earlier. I was going to kind of gloss over this, but I'll discuss it a little bit. This energy transport velocity, the ratio of S compared to U, it's the effective speed of energy density necessary to accomplish the flux S. You see, this energy density that's contained inside of a volume consists of both field energy and energy in the medium, and it's only the field energy that's actually in motion, that part that makes up the pointing flux. There's no mechanical transmission of energy across the boundary. And so when we talk about this being an energy transport velocity, it really is kind of an effective speed or fictitious speed, as though all of the energy included inside were moving at some speed as required to generate the amount of power that the pointing flux alone is delivering. No, I'm not very familiar with his different. Well, what we like to do is just include it all. And in fact, Scott has shown that if you include all energy, then you have a global property. You can show that it's bounded exactly by C. Yeah, I think it's a confusing history, and I'm sort of avoiding it. I'm going to say, basically, and I'll tell you why it's confusing, is because of this constant of integration. Basically, if you're free to add any constant you like, which of course you are because this is a time derivative here, you can make this denominator be anything you wish and come up with any answer. And that's why I think there's been some confusion on that point. And I'm going to insist that we pay attention to that constant. And if you do that in a reasonable fashion, you'll always get a denominator which is at least as big as the field energy have. That is to say, the material does not run a deficit. It cannot give the pulse energy that is not stored in it to begin with. Sure.
I mean, in 2 and 1 papers, they comment on the energy velocity.
Mm-hmm.
Sommerfeld and also by Lowry.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is that their experiment shows that this energy velocity makes no sense at all in their experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Energy velocity is subluminal. They saw a superluminal velocity which agrees better with the group velocity than the energy velocity.
Okay. I would say that in their experiment, I would take the opposite opinion that this ratio does make some kind of sense in their experiment, and that is that energy was not propagating faster than C, only the group velocity. In other words, the energy that came out was already downstream.
But this agrees with experimental results. How can you how can you
argue this point?
Well, this is a conceptual point which doesn't agree with experiments. Okay, that's
well, it's a matter of interpretation. Go ahead.
I'll address this point in my talk tomorrow.
Okay.
You can use the energy velocity, it's very good for you to use the energy velocity, Lowry's energy velocity, to reconstruct all the dynamics of the pulse reactor. And so Lowry's energy velocity is physically correct.
But again, I'm going to return to this point I made, that this is not a true speed. It's an effective speed, that if you consider all the energy in here, what speed should it need to move in order to accomplish the pointing flux? That's the meaning of that ratio. Yeah, I think in those you had a negative energy velocity, and I would say the reason for that is this piece, of course, goes negative, and I would say if you're in an amplifier, you ought to choose your constant large enough that the combination of those two is not permitted to go less than zero. And that would save you from a negative energy velocity.
That's the solution given by Dubois.
Okay, I might be unfamiliar with that.
And also by Enos, okay? But they are in the base. So you should not use the
Yeah, I'm saying there's an integration constant here, and I can pick it all kinds of ways. I would prefer to pick it such that I never run an energy deficit. Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly right. In the amplifier, of course, you have this infinite available C, and that's hard to say. It's not ambiguous in the case of an absorber, in which case it makes perfect sense to leave it zero before the pulse comes.
But why do you absorb it differently from an amplifier? That's rather arbitrary, where you draw the line.
Right, and so I didn't want to overemphasize this. I'm ready to just say, oh, I'm not going to pay attention to that too much. I'm not that worried about it. Yeah.
I don't see why you're trying to attribute physical meaning to that.
I wasn't trying to. I was going to gloss over that in my talk. But we've had a lot of comments from referees and so forth where they really want to know about this energy transport velocity, and so I kind of was... Well, let me just, I'll bring up one more point on this energy transport velocity, and that is you can prove that the ratio, if you include only this piece of the energy, it is definitely bounded by C. And so it's just when you start adding some additional things, and this is the interaction energy. I've repented from calling it the exchange energy because it sounds like fermion exchange or something. But anyway, this is the same thing Scott yesterday was calling interaction energy. But in any case, if you add these other terms on there, if this is going negative as it does in an amplifier, I would just insist on having the constant big enough so that the total U is bigger than U of only part of it. Okay, so that's... okay, well, this is the piece I wanted to concentrate on now, is this exchange energy, which, of course, is the interesting part, or the interaction energy. This was the part that was the P dot E integrated in time. Scott Glasgow showed that this could be represented exactly in the following way. So in frequency space, so you have a chi of omega. It turns out you only need the imaginary part. In here, the thing you're integrating chi against to generate this exchange of energy density between the material and the field, you get this piece that looks like a Fourier transform that's truncated at T. So it's called the instantaneous spectrum. The dispersive term? Well, it was on the previous page. I'm telling you that they're equal, and it's exactly equal. It's not an approximation, but this is how probably we're all used to seeing it. I'm telling you that this integral, if you believe Cramer's Kronig, can be represented exactly, and that's that same piece, as this, chi of omega, and inside the integrand goes this instantaneous spectrum, which is truncated at T. And so as far as the transfer of energy between the field and the medium, as this field is going by this point in the medium, it responds as though it's amplifying according to a pulse perceived up to that time T, which is just chopped off at time T. And so the spectral components in this truncated Fourier transform, of course, can be very different than the spectral components in the entire pulse. So let's look at this E of T of omega, this instantaneous spectrum. Here's a material, an amplifying material. This is an imaginary part of chi. Pulse comes through. This line that I've written here is, we've given the medium just enough energy such that it never goes negative at any point. You can kind of see it taking energy from the material. Yes, and that's exactly the superluminal effect, is it's this bounce that comes up that's tending to be looking like absorption off the back end. Okay, it'll be more pronounced in the next slide. This is a picture of the instantaneous spectrum as this pulse is going through. This, we're again looking at what a point at the front of the medium is perceiving. You have initially very wide wings that can come over here and access these amplification lines, or this amplification peak, and therefore it responds to it in exactly the same way as if the pulse were indeed truncated. But at every new time, it updates that to perceive the truncation further and further along. Okay, this is the an animation of the one that Chow and Bolda had done. Just looking at that example again, in this case we put just enough material or just enough energy that at no point in the medium did we ever get negative energy. So it was the minimum amount of energy necessary to prevent negative energy in the medium. This little black dot is the center of mass of all of the energy that is definitely bounded by C. Again, you see the long forward tail of the pulse being amplified dramatically. That energy that tail is stimulating the medium to release energy, which comes out. And then here later, that energy is reabsorbed. Here's the instantaneous spectrum, which has very little overlap with the amplification gain line here. Early on, it accesses it, and then later on, it narrows up. Oh, it's just a slow motion of that. So again, what we're looking at is the index of refraction. If the resonance peak is off over here a little ways, here would be a pulse which it's the spectrum of the entire pulse is centered here around zero, so off of the resonance peak where there would be amplification. At various times during the pulse, you have different spectra of that pulse up to that time, this instantaneous spectrum. And this exchange of energy, you can see the curve as a function of time. This is the transfer of energy from the medium into the field. You see the medium's giving up energy and continually doing that, and it overshoots there at the bottom. It's sort of like the medium, this point in the medium believes there's all these spectral components, and then it says, whoops, after all, there wasn't those spectral components, so I better give them back. Another situation, this is kind of interesting, similar to Wang's work in the sense that we have a more structured curve here. Here I have an amplification peak that's broad and an absorption peak that's narrow, centered right on it, such that the absorption eliminates the amplification exactly right here in the middle. And then if I send through a very narrow band peak, you see if it's centered right in there, that it should go through essentially transparent. Early on, as the pulse goes through, it has these the point in the front of the medium is perceiving these wide wings in the spectrum, which are coming out here into the amplification peaks. Sure. I didn't understand the question.
You get the broad spectrum from the truncation.
Yes, yeah, early on.
But you realize it's not artificial, that there's a theorem there. The medium responds this way. What's that?
The sampling.
It's the what? Theorem?
Sampling
theorem?
It's real.
Okay.
The way the medium
responds. You might ask, what would happen if the medium indeed actually did truncate? Everything's identical up till the truncation time. So, of course, because of causality, the points in the medium can't respond any differently than if the pulse really indeed continued. But once an actual cutoff occurs, then, of course, those frequencies are real, and you get this enormous amplification that goes on after that point, truncation. So, in summary, the group delay function tracks the presence of field energy and can be superluminal. Energy transport velocity is never superluminal when all relevant energy is considered. I guess maybe I did plan to talk on that since I have a conclusion point about it. Forgot that was there. The instantaneous spectrum governs how a causal medium interacts differently with the front of a pulse than with the back. So thank you. Well, I don't have that big a complaint to leave the word there. But in any case, whether that word is there or not, I see tension between those two statements in the two papers. And if you're going to say that the word virtual saves that tension, then I would strike it. You're talking about superluminal or
subluminal?
Oh, okay. So you're absorbing the front end more than the back. So in this case, you're off resonance. Early on, your spectral wings, perceived spectral wings, lap onto resonance and it absorbs an extra amount. And then later they lap off and it has to compensate. Whether I want to call, I can get into trouble now. So we'd say absorption and followed by some amplification in an absorber, but it's a specially prepared absorber. The front end of the pulse prepared the molecules, atoms, into a certain form such that they did that to the back. So I look at the theorem, and to me that seems physical what's going on. Yeah.
You can store energy in the medium in the polarization. And so quantum mechanically, if I ask what's the probability that I actually make an excitation, you can make that vanish.
But yeah.
And that's true in an amplifier too, if you're far off resonance from an amplifier. You know, I could go way in the wings of an amplifier where
But you see, this is related to what Scott talked about yesterday. If I come with a forward tail of a pulse and it's being absorbed, say, an extra amount, and I actually do truncate, then that was exactly right. If it continues on smoothly, that smooth pulse can be perceived as one of many future fields I could append to extract back things.
I guess it's
and the smooth turnoff happens to give it back better than others.
It's whether you have a rack of elements
right.
in your circuit or not.
Right.
Okay. If I take the limit where the resistance goes to zero, then everything is recoverable energy.
Right.
Right. Because you're never putting it into a resistive element that's in the system. You can make the resistive part of the circuit as small as you want.
Well, it's far away.
How is that virtual though? I mean, because the medium is holding the energy.
But it's totally recoverable. So normally we think of absorption as a non-recoverable. So I think we're just talking semantics.
Well, okay, that's what I tend to agree. We're being a little bit semantic, but here it says that not to pick on you too much, sorry, that the argument that the probe pulse is advanced by amplification of its front edge does not apply. And I would say the argument does apply, whether you want to call it virtual amplification or something. It's the thing that was described by you, I would say, is exactly what's advancing his pulse.
No, I don't agree. The theorem proves it. It shows you can watch the spectrum, you can see it, say, oh, look, there's a resonance here. I found it. I know it.
There is a trunking theory, which we all know. If you're truncating your function, then the spectrum you would reduce.
But this truncation is physical. It happens.
Well, I can truncate anything, then it's no longer the same.
But
that's not a counter argument, though. The point is that medium causality causality knows about the frontal.
No, what I'm saying is,
this theorem says you cannot do that. This theorem absolutely proves you cannot do that. It's irrelevant.
I cannot say you one thing.
It is irrelevant to the energetic.
Joe?
As one begins to object to the word virtual on the grounds that it makes it sound like it's something quantum mechanical. Because if there isn't anything quantum mechanical, that's not on your fault. That's only a sort of associative character that you want to attach to. It's only a coherence phenomenon.
Right. But there are coherence phenomena that transfer over from quantum mechanics.
I agree with the statement. If it's understood the way I think it's meant to be understood, there's no amplification in terms of energy. Because virtual means energy non-conserving. So you can have amplification just something that was reshaping, something that was small gets larger without having had to take energy from the medium. And I think that's what this means.
Well, my comment earlier was when we looked at that movie, for a time, there was more energy in the field present than in the initial or final pulse.
But
and to me, that means that...
The point
sure.
I think is amplification in this quote means to me, reversible process, not an irreversible process.
But I still should then be allowed to say the front end would
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I don't know what else you meant, if not that, in your statement.
Okay. I think this perspective of thinking of it as possible features is a helpful one. Yeah, that would help us to think about what we could have observed up till now. If I'm in the middle of this experiment, and the power goes off in my lab, and I say, well, that's funny, I've already got one power out. I'm allowed to ask where it came from. That's obviously came from the amplifier.
Right. So a comment over there. Okay. Oh, okay. I'm not an expert in that, but...
If you allow me to show this situation,
if you consider this medium to be pumped on cycle, and you have a medium, let's ignore the dot and so forth. You're providing the energy, whatever you call it.
Okay. Well, it depends. I guess it depends on what you mean when you say energy velocity. As we pointed out, there's different definitions.
Let me finish what I mean.
Okay.
The detector sees a higher energy flux. And if I short that detector by a resistor, that resistor heats up faster.
Okay, sure.
In the case of And this is not the valid.
Of course not, because the resistor is getting the energy that was stored in the medium already downstream. It's just that forward tail came through, stimulated it to come out of the medium and go through that resistor.
I would rather argue that the combination of all the different Fourier components space, which is causing all this effect, certainly it's a chicken and egg problem.
Well, I don't think there's any either or dilemma here. I think both pictures are helpful, and they're both going on at the same time. This is a way of looking at it that gives some some other kinds of insights to the group velocity kind of analysis, but there's no conflict between them. I think they're both fine.
I think for that here, that you said that